Support for WPR comes from Lawrence University in Appleton, home to 1,500 undergraduate students from nearly every state and more than 50 countries. Dedicated to an engaging global education. Lawrence.edu. Support for WPR comes from the Dram Corporation, manufacturers of commercial tools, equipment, and systems for greenhouse and nursery professionals for over 80 years. More information is at dramm.com.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio on this Memorial Day Monday. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get the scoop on how to make tasty homemade veggie burgers. First, we're talking to an expert about the oral history program at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. On this Memorial Day, we thought it would be the perfect time to learn about how the histories of Wisconsin-connected veterans are collected and how they're used. Ellen Brooks is with us. She's the oral history archivist for the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. Ellen, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica. Thanks for having me.
So when this oral history program got started, what was the goal initially?
The initial goal was to collect the first-person experiences of veterans from every conflict. We collect stories from veterans of any era and every branch of military. And the initial goal was just to try to get that first-person perspective. We have a lot of artifacts. We have a lot of facts and dates. But we really wanted to learn about what it was like to be in the military, what it meant to serve.
How are stories that are told in person, the way that you collect them in this program, different than written memories, for instance?
I think what happens in an interview, the interviews are conducted either by myself or by our trained volunteers who are mostly veterans themselves. And what can happen in that person-to-person interaction can be somewhat magical. I think people really tend to open up when they have another person in front of them listening and caring about what they're saying. So we have people who tell us things in these interviews that they've never expressed before, that they probably might not have written down before. And so I think what happens there can be very emotional and very, very exciting.
So it sounds like a really precious kind of storytelling that you might not get otherwise. Can you tell us about one or two of the stories or even just a little anecdotes that stood out for one reason or another?
Sure. I think a lot of times what has happened since I've been on board and some of the interviews that I've participated in, I'll be connected by a veteran's son or daughter or grandson or granddaughter, and they're really excited about having their grandfather or grandmother or father or mother's story told, and they just don't know exactly how to go about it. And one of the first interviews I did was actually a grandson who put me in touch with his grandfather, and I sat down with them together, and we did the recording. I, of course, did the questions and all the technical stuff, but to have the grandson there to be a part of it, that was really special.
And so maybe it brings the people together closer within the family.
It does, and I think that sometimes it can be tricky within a family to get your veteran relative to open up about these things. They sometimes don't want to be overly emotional. They don't want to say anything that might be disturbing or unsettling. So I think that having this somewhat professional experience with the Veterans Museum, it kind of helps bridge that gap that might have been there otherwise between veterans and civilians.
How do you find the veterans to collect their stories?
It's predominantly word of mouth, just people telling people about their own experience with the Veterans History Museum. They just let them know that this exists. And we also have been doing some marketing in terms of Facebook, and we've got a new blog out. So we just kind of slowly wait until people come to us. But we're going to start kind of more aggressively doing some outreach. We've got some events planned this summer. So I'll be out there and letting people know that the program exists and they should come share their stories with us.
And so in general, when you've got a veteran who's ready to share their story, do they come to the Veterans Museum or do you go to them?
Either one. We would like to do whatever is most convenient. So we do travel all over the state to interview people if they're more comfortable having the interview done at their home. If they're Madison located, then sometimes we meet up at some type of mutually convenient place. We've actually been using some of the rooms at the main Madison Library, which has been very convenient. I do have a couple interviewers who are based out of Milwaukee, so they'll usually be assigned to the Milwaukee-based veterans. But we go to homes if that's what works the best, and especially with some of the older veterans, that's usually easier, and we just want them to be really comfortable with the experience.
So you are talking about things that I can imagine would be sensitive, that would have a lot of emotional resonance even over the years later. How does the person collecting the story, talking to the veteran, go about, you know, getting trained and making sure that they're a sensitive listener?
Sure. Well, obviously, that's very important, and we take that very seriously. Besides myself, who I have training, I actually have a master's in oral history, so kind of extensive training in the art of interviewing. But I sit down with people who are interested in becoming interviewers, and several of them had been trained before I even took this position on. And a lot of them, I think I mentioned before, are veterans themselves. So that already helps. It gives them a leg up. A veteran tends to feel more comfortable and open up more easily with another veteran. But usually there's a training session that just involves a lot of technical things, how to work the recorder, a lot of, you know, how to handle the paperwork, just to get all of that stuff out of the way. And then just the art of listening. We talk a lot about silences, letting silence be comfortable, taking breaths, reflective questions. So it's usually a session, and then it is also the type of thing that the more you do an interview, I think the better you get, the more comfortable you are. So we've got some really skilled interviewers.
What are these oral histories like, and what kind of stories are the veterans telling?
They're very interesting because they vary so vastly. We've got over 1,900 interviews in our collection now, and some of them are 30 minutes long, and we have one, I found one recently, that was 5 hours of tape.
Wow.
So it can completely depend on, you know, obviously these are personal narratives, so these are individuals that have their own characters. Some are much more verbose than others. Some, you know, aren't that interested in talking. So it can vary widely, and we get a lot of funny stories because a lot of what happens in military service, there's a complete side of humor that I think people often overlook. So we get a lot of funny anecdotes, a lot of stories of friendship and camaraderie, a lot of stories about, you know, getting mail, how exciting the mail is, how bad the food is, a lot of your everyday type stuff. And then we do get some of those harder, heavier combat stories, injuries, near-death experiences. And so it just depends on that certain situation that the veteran went through.
Today is Memorial Day, and we're remembering fallen service people. Mm-hmm. How do people talk about death and trauma in the military and when they're telling these stories?
I think that it's changed a little from the World War II era to today. Not to say that it's gotten any easier. I think that today's veterans, the younger generation, not that it's easy for them to open up, but I think that they may have learned from the past generations. I think it's still a very somber thing, obviously, something to be dealt with a lot of respect. The Wisconsin Veterans Museum is part of the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs, and I think that veterans can go and use these services and these benefits and hopefully find a place to talk and open up. But it's never easy. There's really no good answer for that.
Does there tend to be a moment for the veterans where something transformative happens, especially when they're talking about things that they may have carried with them for a long time? Or is it primarily something for the listener and the people who listen later on?
I think it can definitely be both, and I think it often is both. Some of the people that we've interviewed have turned around and said they would like to become interviewers themselves just because of the relief that they felt. And obviously an oral history is not a therapy session, so we're not asking people to completely bare their souls, and there's a different purpose here, and it is professional. But I think that there is a sense of relief that can happen from the oral history interview, not only sharing your story, but also knowing that that story is going to go and be preserved and listened to and used by future generations.
For those people who are listening who may want to participate in this project or who might have a family member who has a story to tell and maybe hasn't shared it, how can they get in touch and maybe prepare themselves for telling their story?
Sure. The best thing to do is to contact me, and I can go ahead and give you that number and my email. There's also a page on the museum's website, and the website is wisvetsmuseum.com. And there's a little tab at the top that says Veterans, and you can click that, and that will navigate you to a little interview request form. So once I receive that request form, then I get in touch with either the relative who contacted me or the veteran themselves, and we talk a little bit about the program, if they have any questions. And I also send them a sheet that's basically a little what to expect description for the interview, so they can be comfortable. They know what they're getting into going in. Sometimes veterans like to take notes just so they can kind of stay on track with the interview. Sometimes people like to bring in pictures to jog their memory. And that's all fine. We encourage people to prepare in any way that makes them comfortable.
Perfect. Well, Ellen, thank you so much for coming on and sharing this with us today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Ellen Brooks, oral history archivist for the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. It's Memorial Day, and while summer technically starts next month, today kind of is the unofficial start of summer. And with weather in the 70s and 80s around Wisconsin this weekend, it really does kind of feel like summer, which means there's really no legitimate reason not to start grilling out. For all of you grillers, veggie burgers are a pretty popular non-meat option. You probably tried a couple of the things that have availability at the grocery store in the frozen foods aisle. But if you're looking to mix things up, there's a whole world of homemade veggie burgers made with everything from beets to lentils. And here with us now to guide us through the possibilities of the veggie burger world is Terry Milligan. She's a professional chef and culinary instructor based in Door County. Terry, welcome to Central Time.
Well, hello. Thanks for having me. I'm always happy to talk about food.
Well, that's perfect today. Well, part of the appeal of, you know, a beef burger, it's simple. It's ground meat, and it tastes usually charred and juicy and salty. Is that the goal of the veggie burger, to kind of replicate the beef burger experience, or is it just kind of a different animal altogether?
I think it's a different animal because the beef is something, you know, it's pretty straightforward. What you get is what you know you've got. With your vegetable burgers, you need to be a little more mindful of what goes in to make that vegetable burger, because it's got to have a texture that somebody is going to enjoy. It's got to have flavor, and it's got to have enough moisture to hold together, which, if those of you who have tried novicely to make some vegetable burgers might have had some problems with them initially, because it is a delicate balance sometimes to get all three of those to work together.
Well, I think veggie burgers have come a long way. I was someone who was trying them from the very beginning, and I really think now people are getting more creative, and the textures are changing too. What do you think has changed in veggie burgers?
Well, I think the textures change in a variety of ways. It's, you know, used to be you only thought maybe of legumes as your basis of a vegetable burger. But now with all the grains that people are beginning to cook with and feel more comfortable with, they've always been there, but people haven't been that comfortable with them. That's helping out a lot in creating interesting textures, as well as adding vegetables and all sorts of different vegetables and herbs and fresh herbs and dried spices. All of that can really create some interesting flavor profiles in these vegetable-based burgers.
And when you're making veggie burgers, one of the pitfalls can be dryness, that you end up with something that's not at all juicy and just maybe tastes like ground-up beans or something very basic like that. How do you make a veggie burger, you know, kind of moist?
Well, with the legume-based ones, when you're using a chickpea, something like that, you can chop, not really chop them, but kind of mush them like with a potato masher. You want to make sure you still have some of that consistency of a bean in there. You don't want to puree it in a food processor. I like to use just a potato masher. So you still get some of that chunk, but you're also getting some moisture out of those items to work with. Of the lentil burger that I had in the Milwaukee Journal last week was interesting, because you actually cooked the lentils down to such a degree that they were softer than you'd usually make them, and that created additional moisture. So those types of things are ways you can add moisture. Then, of course, you can also add some eggs. A couple of the recipes I have eggs in them, and that creates a little bit of moisture to them as well. And just some of the vegetables that are pure or that are chopped and put in there can create some moisture as well. The chickpea burger that I have in the article has onions in it, but we really ground them up pretty finely initially, so it became more of a a paste almost, and that was created a lot of the moisture in it.
And I'm going to point out that we do have your recipes up on the Central Time Facebook page, including that chickpea walnut burger that you were just talking about. And in terms of getting the whole thing, you know, to stick together on a grill and not fall apart so you're eating veggie burger shards, is there a secret to that?
Well, what I always recommend is actually just searing them in the kitchen in a pan beforehand, because then you've got them seared and kind of together and ready to go. When you're ready to do your, you can do that 2-3 hours ahead of time and just have them seared. When you're ready to do your barbecue outside, I don't recommend just putting them on a grill like you would a normal beef burger, because then you will have the possibility of pieces falling through. But with all the new contraptions that they've got for grilling out, you can get one of those vegetable grill baskets that's flat and it has little holes in the bottom, and it's kind of a Teflon nonstick coating type thing to put on the grill. You can put those pre-seared burgers then on those type of baskets and finish them off there. So you get the smoky flavor, but you're also not going to lose any little bits of vegetable burger down in your charcoal.
Okay, so you're adding an extra step, but as a result, you get a burger that kind of holds together.
You are, and you can pre-sear those, like I said, you know, hours ahead of time. Just keep them in the refrigerator. They're ready to go, and you're, you know, kind of final cooking and heating them up out there.
Would you walk us through another one of your recipes? Let's see, you've got one, the lentil veggie burger with spicy mango salsa. How does that one come together?
Well, that is an interesting burger that is from a place out in California called the Golden Door. And what they did, and I learned this when I was out there doing some work, they cooked those red lentils, and they like to use the red lentils a lot. The red has a little bit more color, so that's kind of makes it a little more, you know, you want things to look good too. So by adding with the you know, the old burgers that we used to have looked like just little hockey pucks. So we want to make it look really pretty. So they've got the red lentils in that are cooked kind of to a thick paste, where you still see a few little lentils in there that aren't cooked through, but a lot of them are more of a paste, and that creates that moisture. And then what's interesting with this one is there's a lot of, like 5 or 6 different vegetables in it, but I coarsely chop them individually in a food processor, not together. And that way you can control the dice. You don't want them pureed. You just want them coarsely chopped. Just takes a second. So you put the broccoli in, then you put the carrots in, then you'll put the potatoes in, and you make sure everything is kind of uniformly chopped. And that gives it an interesting texture as well. And what's nice about this is the seasoning, which is yellow curry and smoked paprika. Not just paprika, but smoked paprika. And that smoked paprika gives it a little smoky taste, and I also usually make this gluten-free. So I use homemade gluten breadcrumbs in it. So that kind of, and it's dusted with cornmeal, which is gluten-free, so we're all set for those who can't have flour and gluten in their diet.
Perfect. That sounds good. How long do these take to make? Do they take a little more time?
Well, they'll take a little more time than just putting a patty together, of course. But I don't think if you've got all, I always say, get all your materials together before you start, and then you should be able to put this together in a half an hour at, you know, with cooking time. And while the lentils are cooking, you can chop your vegetables, then you can put them all together, and you've got it. This one I happen to serve with a mango salsa, which is really just fresh mangoes diced with a little chili, some cilantro, lime juice, and red, if you can afford the lime juice these days, the lime juice, the cilantro, and the red onion.
Okay, and there's one more that we've got to talk about before we let you go, the double-decker portobello. I'm a huge mushroom fan, so what do you do with these guys?
Well, this is a nice one. You're talking about, boy, it takes a little time. This one doesn't take any time. So this is a great one if you want to do a vegetable selection but don't have a lot of time. So find 12 large portobello mushroom caps. Take the stems off. I brush them with a little bit of extra virgin olive oil and a nice quality balsamic vinegar. And this one you can put right on the grill because those are going to stay together quite nicely. So I grill them first with the gill side down, and that's just because some of the moisture from that gill cooking will go away and keep your mushroom burger from getting too moist in this section. And then you can take those off. You just put a slice of tomato, fresh tomato, a little fresh mozzarella, and a couple of basil leaves in between. You could put it on a salad, or you can put it on a bun. And you've got a double-decker. You've got that chew that comes from having that portobello mushroom. And then the flavor of the mozzarella, the basil, and the extra virgin olive oil, and the balsamic vinegar. So it's a really easy one to do in a pinch.
Oh, it sounds really yummy. Well, for non-vegetarians, Terry, who might be skeptical about the veggie burger, what do you recommend as a good jumping off point? And we've got about 30 seconds.
The first one to try?
Yeah.
I would actually go for the chickpea walnut burger, because you've got a little bit of walnut in there for crunch. I think they're going to find it's surprisingly chewy, like a hamburger. So, is courtesy of a restaurant in Milwaukee called Stacked that just does burgers, but they wanted to add some vegetarian burgers to their menu, and this was one of their most popular. So
right.
I think that's a really nice starting out point. Because
great. And we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. Terry, thank you so much, and have a great day.
Well, thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Terry Milligan, professional chef and culinary instructor based in Door County. After a long winter, spring is finally here, and it's a great time to get outdoors and enjoy nature. Since Wisconsin is a big birding state, we thought this would be a good time to listen back to an interview we did with the associate editor of Birding Magazine. He's observed well over 2,000 species of birds around the globe, from Brooklyn to the outback. He says birds are more intelligent and more fascinating than we give them credit for, and that by studying their behavior, we can learn more about what it means to be human. If you've got thoughts on fascinating bird behavior, or maybe some you've noticed yourself when you're out bird watching, you can keep that conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page. Keep it going online there. We listen now to this interview with Noah Stricker, the author of The Thing with Feathers, The Surprising Lives of Birds and What They Reveal About Being Human. Noah, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. It's great to be here.
Well, for a lot of amateurs like myself, even though I grew up in a birding family, the cool thing is sort of looking at a bird and going, that's a robin. Or maybe if you're a little more advanced, that's a scarlet tanager. Well, you've gone beyond that and you're looking deeply at bird behaviors. What's appealing to you about looking at the way birds behave?
Yeah, well, so I've been lucky enough so far in my career to spend some time in very remote places all around the world doing research projects with birds, places like Antarctica and the Amazon and Ecuador and the Australian outback. But increasingly, wherever I go, I'm fascinated not just by the mere fact that birds exist in a field guide to be checked off on a list, but in all the interesting things that birds do. And you can sit down almost anywhere in the world and pick any bird and watch it, and pretty soon it'll start doing something interesting. And that means you can observe interesting bird behavior right in your backyard.
And it's interesting that you're talking about looking at birds and how they teach us about what it means to be human, because typically when we look at what it means to be human, we look at the great apes. We think they're the animals that we have the most in common with. Why do humans have anything at all in common with birds?
Well, if you start thinking about it, birds and people, we need the same basic things, you know, food, water, shelter, a family, maybe like the desire to leave a legacy. And so it's been interesting in writing this book and studying birds in different places. The more I spend time with birds, the more I just find myself comparing them to humans. And I think that's been a trend in the past couple of decades in science, is that, you know, historically we were so focused on what differentiates people and humans from other animals and makes us unique. And that's flipped around recently. And now we're starting to see, okay, well, maybe we're more similar to other animals, including birds, in the rest of the world than we often thought.
One of the birds you start with is a bird that we take for granted, or at best we probably think of them as a nuisance, pigeons. Now, they seem like they're everywhere, especially where there's garbage or something like that. But you found a lot to be interested in when it comes to pigeons. What is it about the pigeon that strikes you as so interesting?
Well, I think pigeons are fascinating. You know, as bird watchers, we are trained not to pay attention to pigeons because they're trash birds and they don't get much respect. But pigeons are everywhere, especially in cities around people. And I think they can teach us some interesting things. You know, homing pigeons are exceptionally good at finding their way home from distant locations. You can put a racing pigeon in a box, take it a couple hundred miles from home, and release it with no point of reference, and somehow magically they make it back home. And you know, that's one thing that if we as humans had as an ability, we'd probably be inordinately proud of. So I think maybe most of all, pigeons can teach us a lesson in humility, because they're capable of things we could never even dream of.
I had no idea until I read your book that there was such a thing as a racing pigeon. Can you tell us a little bit about that subculture and what people do with these pigeons?
Yeah, so racing pigeons go way back to the times of emperors and kings, when people had to send messages across long distances, and they would train pigeons to carry messages attached to their legs and use this magical ability of pigeons to find their way home. And so they would even be used in wars and flown across enemy lines. There were whole squadrons of carrier pigeons used in World War I and even in World War II when radio was coming out, because there were certain situations which required radio silence. Since World War II, the whole sport of pigeon racing has mostly gone to hobbyists, but there's still a lot of people around the world who raise pigeons and train them to fly home to their home loft and then compete against other pigeon owners to see whose pigeons can fly home the fastest.
Wow. So how fast does a pigeon fly? I mean, they're not exactly speed birds, right?
Yeah, they're not the speediest birds in the world. I'd say a pigeon can probably cruise along at about 30 miles an hour or so.
It's respectable. It's faster than people, I imagine.
Yeah.
Well, there was one story about a pigeon that I wanted you to tell. You mentioned pigeons being used in wartime, and there was a pigeon that saved something like 200-plus lives in, I think, World War I.
Yeah, this pigeon, I forget its name, it was called Cherami or something like that, and it was carrying a message that was very important to this military operation, and it flew in enemy territory and was shot, and one eye was blown out and its leg was shattered, but it still managed to make it and deliver its message and saved something like dozens of soldiers' lives. And so it was actually given a war cross, and I think it's maybe the only bird ever to get a serious military medal.
That's amazing. And then they stuffed the bird and put it in the Smithsonian.
That's right. It's in the Smithsonian now.
I don't know if that's a fitting end or not.
Well, I think so. I think that's a place of distinguished honor for a pigeon.
Definitely a place of history, so I guess there's that. Something else I want to talk about, moving on to a different bird, snowy owls. Now, Wisconsin has been at the leading edge of snowy owl eruptions in the last couple of years, the idea being that they leave the Arctic, their natural feeding grounds, habitat, and come south. And usually we think it's because of food shortages. What are we learning now about snowy owls and that behavior of the moving south and wandering?
Well, this winter has been an awesome winter for snowy owls in much of the U.S., especially the central and the eastern parts. And every few years, for some reason, snowy owls, which live in the high Arctic, show up in the dead of winter far south of their usual range, even as far south as sometimes places like Texas. And for years and years, the standard explanation for why these eruptions occurred was food shortages. Snowy owls are known to mostly eat lemmings in the Arctic, and people thought that, well, maybe that was a really bad summer for lemmings, and so that owls didn't have any food to eat, and so they would have to fly farther south to survive the winter. And now we're kind of finding out that maybe that's not the case, that, in fact, it's quite the opposite, that it was a very good summer for lemmings and for snowy owl production in the Arctic. They all had lots of chicks in their nest, and so there's many more owls than usual, and they're essentially just spreading out to find some extra space. And just in the past couple of years, we've been attaching GPS satellite tags to snowy owls that show up in the U.S., and it seems like most of them, as far as we can tell, make it and fly back up to the Arctic the following summer.
And that's interesting, because a lot of times it gets covered as the owls are starving and they're getting hit by trucks and they're being harassed by birders with big cameras, and it's not a pretty story, but you're saying maybe it is.
Yeah, I think when we see these eruptions, we should actually see it as a snowy owl success story, because it's been a very good year for them, and just enjoy when they come and hang around us for a while.
So what does that tell us about being human?
Snowy owls, I think, are an example of a bird with wanderlust, because it seems like they can cover thousands of miles with almost no sweat. Like, it takes some energy for them to fly that far. But even in years when it's just an average year and we don't see any in the U.S., in the southern parts of the U.S., snowy owls will fly thousands of miles west and east across the Arctic. And there have been owls that have been tagged in Canada that have gone all the way to Siberia and back. And they seem to be very nomadic. And there are still a few human cultures in the world that are also fairly nomadic in response to the same sort of conditions, people who live in deserts or very harsh, extreme environments like the Arctic. And so snowy owls seem to have this sort of wanderlust that's also present to some degree in people. And there may even be a genetic basis for some wanderlust behavior in people, which could even be related to the first people leaving Africa. So I think that is all very interesting.
That is interesting. And we just got to say, since we're talking about snowies, that once you've seen a snowy owl, you never forget it. They kind of blow you away, don't they?
They're incredible birds. You know, Harry Potter had a pet one, and you look into their eyes, and it's just this piercing yellow color that seems like it's going all the way down to your very soul.
We're talking with birding expert Noah Stricker, sharing stories of bird behavior and talking about his book, The Thing with Feathers. If you'd like to join in the online conversation, you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Have you observed some bird behavior that puzzles or fascinates you? And what is it about birds and bird watching that makes for such a fascinating time? We continue our conversation now about the hidden lives of birds with birding expert Noah Stricker, of author of The Thing with Feathers. We want to know, are you a birder? Tell us why you birdwatch, and you can share your favorite spots as well. Post your thoughts and your pictures if you've got them on the Central Time Facebook page. And we're going to go to Peter, who's joining us from Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Peter.
Hi, thanks very much for taking my call. I just wanted to tell you that I found a pigeon egg, a fresh pigeon egg on the ground this morning down in Iowa County, Wisconsin. It kind of seems odd that you know, nothing's growing, nothing's going on, but pigeons are starting to lay eggs already.
Yeah.
Can you comment on that? I'll hang up and listen on my car radio.
All right. Thanks, Peter. And Noah, what about that?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, pigeons and doves particularly are known for nesting throughout the year. And like other birds, they tend to nest more often in the spring and summer. So I say it might be slightly unusual to find a pigeon egg this early. But pigeons nest in very urban environments. So unlike birds that are out in the forest or field somewhere, which are depending on natural food, which is going to be more abundant in the spring, pigeons can get all the French fries they want year-round, so they may be able to pull off a nest any time of year.
Ah, interesting. And I want to talk about another bird that you cover in your book, the chicken. Now, this is another bird that I guess chicken fanciers are getting more popular, and people like to keep them in the backyard, but they don't seem that remarkable in other ways. But there's some fascinating stuff that you write about. I, for instance, didn't know that chickens outnumbered people 4-1 starting in something like the year 2000. There's a lot of chickens out there.
Yeah, most people don't know this, but chickens, the domestic chicken, are the most abundant vertebrate animal on Earth. There's more than 20 billion chickens in the world, which is more than any other real animal that you can think of.
Now, are those chickens destined for the fryer?
Mostly, yeah.
Mostly.
I think the average lifespan of a domestic chicken is about 6 months.
That's not a long life. So at least they have some interesting things to do, like peck one another. So tell us about that. The chicken pecking order is something that is complex, but it's also fascinating when you look closely at it.
Well, we tend to throw around the words pecking order anytime we start talking about corporate ladders and, you know, elementary schools and other social situations. But pecking orders are real and alive in nature and serve a purpose. If you look at a chicken coop, inside the coop you'll have, you know, about a dozen chickens usually. And there is a pecking order. The most dominant chicken will always be the first one that eats at the food dish, and then the second one gets to eat, and the third, and so on down the line. And if any chicken tries to jump the order, which they all know and they've all worked out, then it will just get viciously pecked until it goes back to its rightful place in line.
So what does that tell us about people? I mean, do we do the same kind of thing?
I think sometimes we do. And, you know, just imagine if chickens didn't have a pecking order inside a chicken coop. It would just be a free-for-all for every meal, and things would be a lot less orderly. So it may be that pecking orders serve a certain purpose in the world. But I will hasten to add that, of course, we are able to communicate and interact socially, maybe with a little bit more dignity than chickens do.
I hope, although not always, not all the time. Let's go to a caller from Madison. This is Jean on the line. Hi, Jean.
Hi. I heard the conversation about homing pigeons, and I wish my husband was available. He's raised and raced homing pigeons for over 40 years, off and on. And I just wanted to make a comment. He talked about 30 miles an hour. My husband finds that the average, he and his flying buddies from the club, they average about 45 miles an hour. And another fact that's really interesting that we find, my husband actually had a bird return home in a day, 600 miles.
600 miles in one day.
Wow, 600 miles is a long way. Yeah,
it's
that's
a
amazing.
Long way, and it was unusual. They usually don't. They go down at night when it gets dark. They don't fly, and then many birds will come home the next day. We've had a bird come home a year later.
wow.
So we've had lots of fun experiences, but I just wanted to share that they do average 45 miles an hour.
All right. Well, thanks, Jean. The humble pigeon, a lot speedier than maybe we thought. 45 miles an hour is pretty decent for a pigeon.
Yeah, that's pretty fast. You know, most songbirds are 30 or 40 miles per hour, somewhere in that range, and I guess pigeons are a bit faster than I thought.
Excellent. Well, thanks a lot, Jean. And I want to talk a little, let's get away from the domestic birds now, and we were talking chickens. What about parrots? I understand we can learn something about our love of music from parrots.
Yes, you should go to YouTube when you get a chance and type in Snowball the Dancing Cockatoo and see what comes up. There is a video of this cockatoo that just goes at it to the Backstreet Boys. And it's bobbing its head and slamming its feet up and down and shimmying from side to side and just rocking out to this music. And it's funny to watch. It's had like millions of hits, this one video clip. But there was a neuroscientist a few years ago who saw this on YouTube and thought to himself, huh, that's interesting. I've never heard of a bird dancing to a prescribed auditory beat before. And so he decided to do an experiment to see if this snowball could actually time its movements to a synchronized beat. And so he slowed down and sped up that same Backstreet Boys song and then videoed the bird dancing to it at various speeds. And sure enough, more or less, the bird was able to alter its movements and dance in time.
Wow.
Which is pretty interesting because that's never been shown in any other non-human animal before. And this is something that parrots don't really seem to do in the wild.
Because there's no Backstreet Boys in the wild.
There's no Backstreet Boys
presumably.
Out in the wild. And so it seems to show some kind of cognitive, you know, mental ability to train its movements to an external beat. And that probably has something to do with the brain, and it could even be connected to our ability to dance to a beat. And when you get into that, you're suddenly studying things like why do we have music at all in the first place? And even where does language come from? These things are all very closely related.
As we run out of time here, I do want to ask you, though, you've seen a lot of species. Do you have a holy grail bird that you really want to see someday?
Yeah, you know, the bird I've always wanted to see in the wild is called the harpy eagle. And these eagles are feet tall. I mean, they come up at least to your waist or higher. Mm. And they are intimidating. Their main diet in the rainforest, in the jungle, is monkeys and sloths. So they basically fly around picking off monkeys all day long and eating
wow.
them. Their legs are as big around as your wrist, and their talons, if you spread them out, are as big around as a dinner plate. So they are awesome birds, and they're very rare these days. They need big patches of unbroken, fairly pristine rainforest, and so you have to be pretty lucky to see one.
So that's a harpy eagle.
Yeah, H-A-R-P-Y, and they're an amazing-looking bird, too. They're black and white, and they have this spectacular crest, and they're just huge.
Wow, they sound amazing. And I want to talk about one other aspect before we let you go. Self-awareness is something that's often seen as uniquely human or close to unique. Anyhow, maybe we're learning more about that. But it is something that, as humans, we tend to look at an animal and we judge about how self-aware it is and therefore how closely related it is to us. Do birds show signs of self-awareness?
The question is, when an animal looks in a mirror, what does it see? And we tend to spend so much time looking in mirrors ourselves and recognizing our own reflection that we tend to forget quite how unusual that habit is. There's not a lot of mirrors out in nature. And from what we can tell, most animals in the world can't actually recognize their reflection. If you put most birds in front of a mirror, they'll start attacking their reflection or trying to mate with their reflection or walking around the backside of the mirror to look for this other bird. But nevertheless, a couple years ago, there was this group of German researchers that decided to try the mirror test, as it's generally known, on a group of captive magpies. And they pretty much showed that two of these individual Eurasian magpies, which are very intelligent birds, were able to recognize their reflection in a mirror because they put a little speck of paint on the magpie's chin, and when the magpies looked in the mirror, they started scratching their chins like, oh, weird, I have something strange on my face, I better get it off. And so the question then becomes, what does that mean? And we know that as humans, when we're about a year and a half to 2 years old, that's when we start recognizing our own reflections. And that comes with a lot of other emotional characteristics.
And like, so we may have magpies that are at the beginnings of self-awareness. But I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there. No, it's been fascinating.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was Noah Stricker, and he's with Birding Magazine. His new book is called The Thing with Feathers.